just been reading an absolutely riveting book titled Apology to a Young Addict, a Memoir. This is an extraordinary book, and yet another extraordinary book from acclaimed author James Brown. And you may know him already from two previous memoirs, The Los Angeles Diaries and This River. His writing has appeared in many other places as well. James Brown's own story is that of very serious, nearly life-threatening addiction and recovery. And beyond recovery, a life devoted in large measure to reaching out to others who have found themselves in the dark, dangerous pit where he has been. And this is a really fascinating book that shows us many sides of addiction and the various costs that are inflicted, not only those that are addicted, but those in their immediate circle, those that care about them. It is a story of sometimes inspiring redemption, sometimes frustrating failure and setbacks, all told with disarming honesty. And with a masterful choice of words that I very, very much appreciate. The book is published by Counterpoint, again titled Apology to a Young Addict, a Memoir. And James Brown, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for having me on the show.
I wonder if, ahead of us having a conversation specifically about your book, if you could just, in sort of the barest sort of fashion, sketch for our listeners, it sounds kind of foolish to say sketch your life story, but the sort of barest outlines of your story, because I think that will be helpful context then when we probe into some of what you more specifically explore in your book.
Addiction in my family began very early for myself, or at least the process of becoming addicted, but it also affected my brother and sister, both of whom took their own lives because they couldn't continue to drink and live, and they couldn't continue to live and drink. My mother was also a career criminal at an early age after she was released from prison. She took myself, my brother and sister, older brother and sister, to Los Angeles, and for the most part, she was an absentee mother, and we raised ourselves. And as for myself, I ended up gravitating towards the parks of Los Angeles. But it became increasingly a darker story as time went on, and my brother, who was a successful actor, Barry Brown, starred in Daisy Miller with Cybill Shepherd and Jeff Bridges, a movie called Bad Company, took his life at the age of 27. My sister followed by jumping over the overpass of the Los Angeles River, and that's quick summary of the background of my life.
Right. This book, newest book, Apology to the Young Addict, has been called in some circles the completion of a trilogy, coming on the heels of two previous memoirs, and at least one of those, I understand, really dealing very specifically with your own family, its dysfunction, and the legacy of addiction. From the outset, was this always your intention to tell your story kind of in this fashion and over the course of several different books, or was it kind of in the midst of the telling that you realized that all that you had to say about this could not possibly be contained in one single book?
Good question. It wasn't planned necessarily. The first book, The Los Angeles Diaries, dealt with my brother, sister, myself, our addictions, and ultimately their suicides, and dealt with my immediate family. And I come to terms with my addiction at the end of that book, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, although I came to terms, that I got sober. And that's the second book, This River, dealt mostly with some very bad setbacks and relapses, and my own personal family of my three children and my wife at that time. And again, it was about the struggle to get sober. And the third book, this one here, came as a result of, excuse me, came as a result of having maintained sobriety for 12 years. And then I thought, well, this is the time now to write about what it's like to be recovered and trying to help others through sponsoring and through talking, going to the prisons, and rehabs and colleges and high schools, and trying to spread the word of recovery.
One of the things I wanted to specifically mention is that several months ago, I had the opportunity to, on this program, interview the author of a very interesting book called Writing the Big Book, which I understand to be one of the very first accounts in whatever detail is even possible all these years later, of the writing of the so-called big book that is kind of at the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous, and also telling the story of the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous and those persons who most chiefly figured in that. I wonder if we could just take a moment and have you give your own perspective on AA itself and what kind of experience it has been for you. I mean, obviously a very redemptive one, but if you believe that this is, in a sense, the best pathway for anybody who finds themselves in the dark place that you did, or if this is a pathway only for some, I just wonder now with your perspective as someone now sober for many years, what your perspective is about this particular path.
Another good question. It would be presumptuous for me to say that AA is the only way to get sober, clean and sober. It would be presumptuous for me to say that AA isn't a wonderful way to get sober, get clean and sober. There are other methods out there. There are other rehabs out there, and they have a decent success rate. AA has its own. The nice thing about AA is that it doesn't cost you anything except your willingness to get sober and the desire to get sober. You're with other alcoholics and addicts, and they are all share the same goal, which is to change their lives, look at their persons, look at their character, re-examine and reset. So AA and AA is a solid program, and I would not have been able to write this book had I not been a member of AA. I don't think I'd be alive if it wasn't for AA. The people I met there, the people, the support that I received there, the friendship, the camaraderie, the fellowship, all of those things were essential to my recovery. On the other hand, I'm not going to say that there aren't other ways to achieve sobriety. But AA's been around for quite a while, and there's a reason why it's been around for quite a while.
Your own experience of addiction is certainly dealt with a great deal in this book, although I think it's safe to say that your own addiction is not the central focus. But it really is the central focus of one of the chapters, certainly called A God of My Understanding. And I'm so glad that you take the time in this chapter to talk about this particular facet of your AA experience and your experience of recovery. And it involves what I guess is the second step of those 12 steps, and that is the acknowledgement of a higher power. Something which, as you first encountered AA, you were really not prepared to do. I wonder if you would tell our listeners a little bit about your own journey in this particular respect, and why you think it was important to share about this in the careful detail that you do.
Another good question. Yeah, you're on a roll here with good, sharp, intelligent questions, not easily answered. The acceptance of a higher power was, for me, very problematic. I've lived for the bulk of my life as either an agnostic and / atheist, and I had a hard time accepting the notion that there was a power greater than myself, because so many bad things had happened in my life, and I had to you know, I thought, well, if there's a God, well, then how come all these things have happened? So my resistance to believing in God was pretty intense for quite a while. But as I began to sink deeper and became more frustrated and have more relapses, I came to the conclusion that maybe if I just let my guard down and accept the possibility that there was a God, that that little bit of faith, the next step became for me a belief. And that was the beginning of my consistent sobriety. I needed personally, because I had done things that I wished I hadn't done. I'd done hurtful things, I'd done cruel things, things that I couldn't necessarily forget, things that I had a lot of regret for. And I needed to be forgiven in order for me to be advanced, in order for me to advance in my sobriety. And that was my belief in a higher power that had the ability to forgive me, that enabled me to shake some of this burden that was on my shoulders and be able to move forward and start a new life.
When you were speaking with your sponsor, Nick, about this specific matter, as you recount it in your book, in this chapter, sitting in a booth in a place called Bill's Diner, his advice to you in trying to come to terms with this aspect of a higher power is to simply pray. Go ahead and pray. It doesn't matter to what or to whom you pray, but just pray. Promise me you will pray at least once a day. Explain what it's like to pray when you really do not believe that there is anybody on the other end listening to those prayers. I mean, how would you describe kind of what the nature of those prayers were? And if you think they made any difference at that point in your journey of recovery?
Boy, you asked some very good, insightful questions. The physical act of prayer, for me, initially, was essential. And yes, it did seem awkward, because what was I praying to? And who was listening to me? Or was anything listening to me? But the physical act of getting down on my knees and praying, asking for help, asking for advice, asking for direction, that began a conversation with what became my God. And so this, the going through the motions of prayer was the first step. The physical action of going through the motions of prayer was the first step to leading to an emotional connection to a power greater than myself.
What has you... As you describe this this experience, at one point you talk about a very harrowing trip on one night, driving drunk through fog, and you are very, very nearly killed. And of the many, many, many times that you drove drunk, you never had a serious incident of any kind, which in and of itself is... something and an astounding miracle, but in the wake of a really, really close call on this harrowing trip, something happens which opens a door for you. Tell our listeners about this.
I was driving up the mountain in a fog, and as you said before, it was very treacherous and dangerous, and I was drunk, and I had to keep one eye closed so I wouldn't see double. And as I was driving up the mountain, and very, very scared and very, very, you know, full of anxiety, and I had a close call with going over the side of the mountain. I live at an altitude of about 6,000 feet, and we go from ground zero to 6,000 feet in about 13 miles. So we're talking about a steep climb. And something occurred that is a phenomenon that is still, you know, it's still perplexing, but quite wonderful, is I heard a voice. and the voice I heard was very simple: I'm here. And it meant to me at that time that I felt a presence beside me, and I was shocked to hear a voice and feel a presence. And at that moment, not did I not just feel a sense of comfort and safety, but at that moment and later on, I came to realize that maybe I've never been alone, that all the close calls I've had with death, which is, I've had a gun to my head, I've had a knife to my throat, I've been on the streets of San Bernardino, can be very dangerous. It's one of the most dangerous cities in the United States, and I was out there running amok in early morning hours with some very dangerous people for many years of my life, off and on, and began to think, well, I'm not this tough guy, that was able to avoid, death, I was able to avoid being killed, this or that. I was actually perhaps being protected. And I came to believe as time passed that there was a presence. I choose now to consider it as a guardian angel. But at the time, I had no idea that someone was watching out for me.
Hmm. One other thing about this chapter that I wanted to ask you about, and that is in the wake of this experience, as you begin praying in a different way, you begin to come to terms with the need to forgive yourself and the need to forgive others, and in particular your own brother and your own sister, who, as you've already mentioned, took their own lives. And you talk about how, for as long as you could remember, all you really thought about in terms of the two of them was the horrible way in which both of their lives ended. In this moment, what did you manage to do? In what way were you able to step outside of the horror of their own suicides and see them differently? And what kind of lasting difference did that make for you in your own recovery?
That question there is a tough one to answer emotionally, but I can tell you that when my brother took his life and when my sister took her life, I was left with a sense, I felt betrayed, I felt angry, and that fueled my addiction. Basically, it gave me a reason to drink more. I lost my brother, I lost my sister, the world was terrible, life was terrible, and why not drink? Why not follow my brother and sister? And I became to the realization when I was able to get brief moments of sobriety here and there that I needed to look outside my own feelings and my own self and look at the people who loved me, the ones around me, and the ones that would suffer as I'd suffer if I chose to take my own life, the kind of haunting that would leave them with. And I began to realize that my life was not necessarily my own, but that it belonged to other people, my sons, my wife, my friends, and I could not do to them what my brother and sister had done to me. And in staying in that dark past, in living and remembering on a regular basis, on a constant basis, the suicide, being haunted by the suicides of my brother and sister, I was robbing those that loved me of myself. I could not give myself until I was able to at least release the memories of my brother and sister into forgiveness. And when I was able to recognize that whatever reasons that they decided to check out of this life early, it was not for me to judge any longer. It was not for me to blame any longer. It was for me to let go, and so that I could live a good life, so that I could get clean and sober, and so that I could be an active, loving participant in those that loved me.
Mm. Here is one thing you say in this chapter in talking about this: in residing in the darkness, in fixating on the tragic, I am also robbing myself of the ability to remember my brother and sister in better times. They are more than alcoholics, and I dishonor them and all they mean to me by distilling their lives into their last moments of blinding pain. I dishonor them and myself by living in misery and mourning. I was very struck by those words because I have known people in my life, not in these specific circumstances, but who in some misguided, if well-meaning way, thought they were honoring the memory of someone they loved by, in a sense, remaining steadfastly in that place of darkness and misery, not really realizing that that's not what those loved ones would have wanted them to do. But it's interesting what the choices we sometimes make, thinking we are honoring somebody we have lost.
Yes, yeah, you're right there, and that's exactly what I got caught up in. And I didn't want to let go of that because I felt, ironically, that I would be dishonoring them by not remembering their final days. But in doing so, I had divorced myself from the possibility of remembering them for much better days and the people they were before they began their descent. And I know in my heart that they loved me, and I wasn't necessarily part of the decision of why they chose to leave early. But I do know that they would not have wanted me to linger, to be haunted by their deaths. And I had to let that go, too, in order to move forward with my life. And, as you said before, honor their memories for, the better sides of themselves. And not to forget those things, because those things were the things that brought us together.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author James Brown about his newest book, which is called Apology to the Young Addict, a Memoir. I don't think we should go any further without me asking you to explain the title of your book, which also is the title of one of the most poignant chapters in the book. Explain to our listeners what is behind this title and how, in a sense, it really is very fitting for this wide-ranging, deeply moving memoir.
The title it has to do with what I think are the greatest casualties of addiction, and they have to do with the active addict and the influence the active addict has over those that have yet become addicted. And those are typically children or teenagers, and if they see mommy and daddy using and abusing, the likelihood of them using and abusing is greater. And we don't think about that. Addicts don't think a lot about anything other than themselves and getting high. And in the process, the next generation of addicts comes right along following in our footsteps. And I believe, as a recovering alcoholic and addict, that my responsibility now is to set an example and not to follow that same path, or not to encourage anyone to follow that same path by example. And I need to, by example, be clean and sober and show that there's a better way to live. And as I said before, the youth of today are our greatest casualties of the behavior of the adult addict and alcoholic. Mm-hmm.
I want to be sure to ask you about the opening chapter of this book, which I found to be one of the most remarkable. It's titled The Good Neighbors, and this is a story that is quite surprising. I did not, as I began reading it, I had no idea where this was going or why this chapter was part of this book, and I'm very glad it's there. It's really an incredible story. Maybe you could first of all kind of summarize what this story is about and then explain why you chose to open the book with this story.
Good question again. This story is about my elderly next-door neighbors, and they were healthy and strong, and I'd say they were in mid-70s. They were still out and about working in the yards, working in the gardens.
Former athletes and vigorous people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were former athletes. One participated in Olympics, and I think it was volleyball. And the other was played in USC for basketball. These are very healthy, elderly, active people. And then they suffered during the cold winter up here where we live in Lake Arrowhead. They suffered a fall. Well, both of them did in a short period of time. They went to the doctor. The doctor, well, one had a hip replacement. It was placed on pain medications after the post-op. And the other also slipped and wrenched his back, the husband. And he also was given pain medications. And then I believe they were given anxiety medications. Then they were given sleep medications to help them sleep through some of the recovery period. The problem is that they begin to depend on all those different prescriptions. And their lives begin to, where they were once athletic, ski, where they were once out gardening, all these things that they used to do disappeared. And they became extremely reclusive, and their lives were pretty much built around getting their next prescription filled. When the doctor wouldn't fill the prescription to their satisfaction, they began to go to different doctors to get those prescriptions filled. And that began their descent, and ultimately they ended up losing everything. They spent their savings, they didn't pay their mortgage, they lost their home. And the city, or the county of San Bernardino, literally came and took them away one day and put them in, one in a rest home and the other in a rehab, I believe it was, and until they were able to get back on their feet. And then from there, the story ends on a happy note. I get a call from them. I've forgotten how long it was afterwards that they had had been taken from their homes, and I find out that they were clean and sober, and they're healthy again, and they were living together in a little apartment in Palm Springs. So it had a happy ending that they were able to turn their lives around, even at that late stage, and even though they were deeply addicted for at least 2 or 3 years prescription medications.
It's an intriguing place to begin your story, to begin this book, I should say. Was there any particular reason why you thought this was a good place to begin?
Honestly, I would like to say I had a strategy for that. but it was my agent who suggested that I open the book with that particular piece. I thought it was a little long. I thought, well, maybe I should have a short piece to open with, to try and draw the reader in, because it's a longer piece in the book. And he thought, no, you should begin here. And so it was the agent that made the decision to, or suggestion, I should say. And I took the suggestion because I thought it was a good one. And to begin the book with my next door elderly neighbors.
Well, I think one of the reasons it was very powerful for me was because I think when I read memoirs like this, most of the time I feel like I am reading a story of something that is happening to strange people on another planet, far from the planet where I live, just because this is so outside the realm of the rather cautious, careful life that I have lived that has never included any of this. And but this opening story makes us realize that the web of addiction can ensnared really just about anybody, and including people whom we would never imagine could become part of something like this.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Well, addiction sadly does not discriminate. It can take any of us from any social status, any economic status, any race, gender. It doesn't discriminate. It takes from wherever it wants to take. And even those that we think are not vulnerable are indeed vulnerable. So it affects all aspects of society, from the upper classes to the middle classes to the lower classes, however we want to categorize it. Addiction does not discriminate. Hmm.
I think it's also an interesting story because you and your wife, is her name Paula? Am I remembering that right?
Yes, you are.
You were good neighbors. I mean, this couple, they were good neighbors to you. You were good neighbors to these folks, and then this happens, and life changes for them, and rather quickly, your relationship begins to change, and without meaning to, you find yourselves kind of drawn into their addiction, and to some extent, perhaps even enabling it to a point before finally you've felt compelled to pull away rather dramatically. Explain to our listeners a little bit about what I'm talking about and how difficult that was for you to find yourselves in this kind of situation.
Well, the first off is that they're elderly, and I have elderly neighbors on both sides of me. And when they need something, I am obliged to help them because they're older and they can't do everything they want to do for themselves anymore. And so it's part of being a responsible person is helping those who need your help. And so in the beginning, as their addiction continued to take hold, but before it manifested itself entirely, we would, you know, help them with their errands. We would help take them to the doctor. We would take them to, you know, to the pharmacy. But as their addictions began to develop and became more and more apparent that they were ill, ill in a way that I couldn't help, just as you said earlier, we began to realize we were enabling their addiction. And at that point there, we couldn't help them, and they would continue to call and ask for our help, but their help was, it had a design, and the design for the most part was help us feed our addictions, and that I couldn't participate in, but also in, if you want to add gravity to it, because I was am a recovering alcoholic addict, and I knew what was happening to them, but so I had to, we had to cut the relationship, and it was hard because I wanted to help them because they needed help, but at the same time I didn't want to enable them in their addiction.
It's an incredible story, and it's important because I think a fair number of people, if even they themselves are not addicts themselves, might find themselves impacted by addiction, either by someone they love or someone they just care about or find at some point in their life. And what is it that we should do to help and not hinder them, assist and not enable? I mean, there are some very, very hard choices that are part of this. In another chapter of the book called The Last House on the Block, you sketch the journey of recovery, and it's in some ways a little unclear if this is your own story or in general the story of recovery, but there are different headings like day 1, day 8, day 30, day 60. And you really take us inside this journey in a way that I don't ever remember experiencing before. Explain why you thought it was so important for this sort of facet of the story to be told in this way, with these clear benchmarks. What does this tell us about recovery that some of us might otherwise not know?
Well, the good points again. You're a very perceptive reader, asking well-informed questions and required for me good answers. I broke it into those different parts in large to simulate the various stages that the alcoholic addict goes through as they go through recovery. We're not unique. Many of us share the same issues, that any alcoholic addict would. The early stages of recovery, the first week or two, the physical withdrawals, those are very little. They're hardly anything compared to the psychological repercussions that you're going to ultimately have to battle when you're trying to maintain your sobriety. So in the early stages, once we pass through the physical withdrawals, we have a much bigger obstacle, and that's ourselves and our mindset. And so I tried to replicate the ambivalence as we get more sober time under our belt, 30 days, 60 days. There's still a state of ambivalence there where we might say, well, I've had 30 days here. I'm not an alcoholic. I could drink again. I went a whole month without drinking, or and we say this, and we might say the same thing at 90 days. And in AA, we take a 30-day chip, we take a 90-day chip, we take a 6-month chip, and those are little benchmarks in, you know, en route to getting and staying sober. And there's a lot of parallels. I mean, with each alcoholic and addict that goes through these stages, that are more similar than dissimilar. And so I wanted to try and replicate that pattern. And finally, I think I end with getting 1 year sober, and that's the benchmark. If you can make 1 year sober and come to terms and admit that you are an alcoholic and addict who cannot safely ever drink or use again, that 1 year mark is a milestone. And of course, you know, the journey continues as you move forward, and you can never forget who you are, where you came from.
One of the relatively small moments in this really fascinating chapter I want to just give you a moment to talk about is, and let me see where we are in the journey. This is in the section called Day 60, which begins, "You almost don't make it. Make this next stretch." And you go on to explain, you know, what the addict, the recovering addict, experiences at this point in their journey. But at one point in this section, you say this: "The next day, inspired by your newfound resolve, you go through the contact list on your smartphone and choose whose numbers to keep and whose to delete. It is one of your hardest duties to date, but you convince yourself that it's necessary, that it's for your own good, your own safety." This is really interesting, because I think most of us from the outside looking in would never think that something like this could matter. And yet, when we think about it a little bit, of course it matters. This step in and of itself is not, you know, one of the 12 steps, but this move can make all the difference in the world. Is this something you remember from your own experience?
Yes, it is. I think it's a decision that alcoholics and addicts all ultimately have to make, and that is that how many of our friends are real friends or just friends that we drank and used drugs with, and if those, and we considered them friends, but we had nothing really truly more in common than the drinking and the using. And those are the friends that really need to go when we're talking about getting clean and sober, because their influences would not be what we need at this time when we're struggling to stay clean and sober. And yeah, I found as I went through my contact list that there were very few people that I could call real friends that, one, supported me in my decision to get clean and sober, and two, we went out to dinner, they would not drink around me because they knew that it might be upsetting. And so until I got comfortable, eventually, you know, now I can go out with other people and they can have drinks in front of me, and I can even sit at a bar in Las Vegas and play the video poker without feeling like I'm going to relapse. But there was a time when I couldn't do those things. And so I did have to make some decisions as to who to keep in my life and who to let go.
I love the term you use at one point of unlearning in the chapter called A Real Disease. And this is at a point when you're talking about working with young addicts. And you say, "Here we are unlearning the things that once brought us together and replacing them with new things, new ways of coping that serve to affirm our lives rather than ruin them." One of the things I love about the way you say that is that this helps us understand what it really means to rebuild your life and to build true recovery versus just stopping a behavior that was hurting yourself. I mean, if you stop that but don't replace it with anything, no wonder people relapse. And in a sense, this process of unlearning old things and replacing those old things with new things, that's critical to all of this working out and being a sustained recovery. And I suspect this is a process in which you are still engaged to this day.
Yes. Yes, it's a learning to live life on life's terms. and we have to rethink our old ways, and many of our old ways were, if we're depressed, reach for that drink. If we're, if it's, you know, a wonderful day, let's try and make it better by reaching for that drink. And it's so in that regard, no, you don't reach for that drink. There's other ways to enjoy your life. And one thing that is kind of a myth, one of the things that I worried about was, well, if I take the drink away from me and I take the other things away from myself, I'm not going to, life is going to be boring. And that's not the way it is. It was just the opposite. Life was actually as if they turned on the lights in a dark room. I could see and experience things I hadn't been able to see and experience because I'd been spending most of my time in a dark room. And then, of course, your value systems have to change. Your sense of decency, honesty, sense of respect, all these things are things that most addicts and alcoholics don't have. And so getting back to those values, those qualities, we had to retool, relearn, because we lost those things along the path of alcoholism and drug addiction.
Right. And one of the things you say in your book is that one of the best gifts of sobriety is how we come to appreciate lives other than our own. I mean, we're pulled out of that sort of abyss of selfishness and begin to see the world and everyone in it in a different way. It's an incredible book. I learned so much and drew great inspiration from it. I look forward to sharing it with some people I think who need to read it, and I hope many people will seek it out. Again, Apology to the Young Addict, a memoir, published by Counterpoint, the author James Brown. James Brown, thank you so much for writing this book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. This was a real pleasure and honor for me.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for reading my book so closely. I really appreciate that, and I appreciate this opportunity to share my story. It's been great. I appreciate it.
And to finish out the hour, here's a chapter from James Brown's book, a chapter titled, This Little Boy. This little boy lives in the apartment across from mine. His hair is blonde. His eyelashes are so light as to be almost invisible in the sun. He is underfed and thin, and his button-down shirt is too small for him. His jeans are some off-brand picked from the bargain bin at Sears or JCPenney or the racks of the Salvation Army. Only the poorest of us wear anything but Levi's, and he is among them, this little boy. I'm 6 years old, and he's maybe 7 or 8. One front tooth overlaps the other, and the bottom row is crowded together. We don't know each other. I never knew his name. He is a child like me growing up in a cheap apartment complex in East San Jose. I sometimes tell myself that I have no reason to remember him, and yet here I am, 60 years old, still thinking about this little boy. I sometimes tell myself that I made him up, that he's another character in some story I started a long time ago and never finished. But he's not. He's real. And if I were to write a story about him tomorrow, I'd change it up so he wouldn't be skinny because there was no food in the cupboards. I'll make sure he always has some mac and cheese on hand and plenty of peanut butter and jelly. Milk, certainly there will be milk in the refrigerator, and eggs and bread. There's no reason not to have a loaf of bread around. These things are cheap enough. And if for whatever reason he does have to go hungry, as children in America sometimes do, it won't be for more than a day or two, and never because his mother is a negligent alcoholic. If they're down on their luck, it's because she lost her job, but she's looking hard for another, not sitting around all day drinking wine from a box. But this is precisely how I remember her, a middle-aged woman with thin, tight lips, sitting on a beat-up sofa chair on her apartment balcony. On a small table rests the box of wine, and nearly every day when I come home from school, or on warm summer nights when I step out onto my own apartment balcony, there she is on hers across the way, drinking that cheap wine, chain-smoking and flipping through the glossy pages of some gossip magazine. Of course, at my age, I don't know yet what an alcoholic is. All I think is that she is lazy. Now I believe that she is both. Because I've since learned how quickly alcohol can turn on you, make you mean when it once made you happy, and how that meanness left unchecked can sicken the soul and the mind. But I also don't believe in excuses. Certain acts, regardless of circumstance, are beyond justification. In my story, I won't hear the boys scream through the thin apartment walls. There won't be any late-night scenes where my father climbs out of bed and puts on his bathrobe and slippers and goes to their apartment. She never opens the door, but the screaming always stops, usually subsiding into sobs before it's quiet again. And when a woman in a pantsuit, a man in a dress coat, and a police officer come to the apartment one day to take the boy away, it will have nothing to do with alcoholism and the cruelty that often accompanies it. In my story, the authorities are making a mistake. She's really a good mother who loves her child, and those marks on his arms and legs and back are from falling off his bicycle or getting into fights. This boy is no scrapper. He's weak and scrawny with crooked teeth, and his skin is white in a mostly brown and black neighborhood. Of course he's going to get a little banged up. If it's a teacher who reports him to the authorities, she has it all wrong. He's gone for about a month. It's not how long he's gone that gets to me, though, so much as how far he must have had to walk. I'm sure they didn't place him in a foster home down the street or around the block. This little boy embarks on a serious journey. Imagine a 7 or 8 year old navigating miles and miles of twists and turns of suburban neighborhoods and city streets. Imagine him crossing a busy intersection during rush hour. And how can he remember the way home? Does he have a map? Can he even read one at his age? I'm sure he gets lost. Undoubtedly, he has to backtrack more than once and ask strangers for directions. It's exhausting, too. His legs ache, his feet throb, and as the day slips into night, fear sets in. So maybe this kid is no scrapper, but that doesn't mean he isn't tough inside. I respect his grit and determination, his resolve, his devotion and tenacity. It's something primal that drives him. That's how I'd write it, anyway. The story of a boy unjustly wrenched from the arms of his loving mother by heartless authorities, but ultimately, against all odds, child and parent are reunited. It's right against wrong, good against evil. Late at night, after a grueling journey, this boy finally arrives at the doorstep of his apartment. His mother pulls him to her bosom and holds him tightly as he longs to be held, and the cries I hear through the thin walls of my bedroom are ones of joy. The tears are from happiness, not agony. So the part where the same night she burns holes in his arm with a cigarette doesn't belong in my story. I need to create a different truth. I need to revise. I need to make it mine, when in fact, I can do no such thing. But I can lie. I can make this a place where there is no human cruelty. In my story, I can reinvent the boy I cannot forget and remember him not for the pain and suffering he endured, but for the haunting power of a child's love for the parent, no matter how perilous that love may be. A chapter from James Brown's beautiful book, Apology to the Young Addict, a memoir. Published by Counterpoint. I'm Gregory Berg. ¶¶